What show do you do?
It's called Polycast.
On the internet, is it?
Welcome to Polycast Episode 11, brought to you by Duct Tape.
Isn't this the only thing holding us together along with spit and bailing wire?
We couldn't afford that. We had to just go with the duct tape, actually.
Well, it's just a handyman's secret weapon.
This one voice is yay.
Blake was thinking, thank goodness someone other than just Dan. No.
Oh, no, so he'd be doing Polycast with Dan alone. And, of course, all of you already know Dan. I'm Makalua, and Blake's joining us again this time.
Hi.
Yeah, Blake, who needs more coffee.
So I said, are you available for the next 1.5 hours per chance and feel up to doing something you've done before, but with less possible preparation this time?
Well, actually, it means he'll be just about as prepared as Imran usually is.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, it's terrible of me. I'm hitting a poor man while he's down.
Yes, Imran is not able to join us at the last moment. He said that he was hawking up a lung still. And we don't know where Wouter is. Maybe he's starting a new venture. Say, group of girls playing Civ.com.
You're not going to give that up, are you?
No. No one has still taken us up on the offer from Episode 8 for a Lifetime Plus subscription, which is kind of sad.
Maybe everybody listens already has Plus.
A Lifetime subscription for what? What are they to do? I miss it.
During the listening of Episode 8, I inserted a couple of sounds that certain units can make if you use the Canada mod for Civilization 4. And all I said was that if people called into the show and left a message and told us what minute they heard each of the sounds in, they would get a lifetime subscription to a Polton Plus. So, right here on Polycast, we are actually, hopefully, going to close this contest, because I'm now going to tell Blake what the answers are. And all he has to do is repeat them back to me, and he will have a lifetime subscription to a Polton Plus.
Nifty.
Isn't that, aren't I nice?
Yeah.
You see, all these years I have been everyone's favorite dictator. See, I'm rewriting history. 31 minutes and 43 minutes.
31 minutes and 43 minutes.
Yay, Blake, you now have a lifetime subscription to Polton Plus. You are the first winner of a contest for Polycast. And for those who are saying now, this is a conflict of interest. Blake is a guest co-host. Well, given the circumstances, I think it's more than fair.
I expect there's as many hosts as listeners, so there's not much distinction.
Oh, hey! Hey! In the news, we look at Take-Two Interactive revenue up, investors unhappy, and no, they're not directly related. Academics rate Civilization 1 and Civilization 2 amongst the 10 important games of all time.
And this week in the modcast, we talked about Civilization and Games for Windows Live upcoming on Vista. Civ 4 is the ultimate economics lesson, although not maybe quite the economics you're thinking of. And our fortress is useless. You think you know the answer to that one. And is future tech overpowered?
Forts.
Hey, it says fortresses on the top of the title.
On Messina, we talked about using open borders to attack third parties and related strategies like stationing aircraft in the cities. And in part one of our discussion on wonders, we talked about which wonders to build, with Dan providing his list of top 10 best wonders. Due to a lack of time, I had to leave Dan's list of top 5 worst wonders for a future episode.
And we might have disagreed with him on a few of those.
Yes.
Imagine that. I was going to choose that wonder, but then Dan said, now I have to disagree.
No, it's not how it happened.
In the news, Take-Two Interactive, revenue up, investors unhappy. Now, it should be said that you should consider that as Take-Two Interactive, revenue up, period. Investors unhappy, period. Not that investors are unhappy because revenues are up, because that would just be silly.
Yes, when I first read your note about that, I was thinking, wait, they're unhappy because there's more revenue? What? And I actually read the article.
You were right, so...
It's two items in one. Take-Two Interactive, publisher of Civilization IV, Borderlands expansion, and owner of both developer Firaxis Games and the Civ franchise itself, has announced its fiscal first quarter 2007 results. We have net revenue, but we still have a net loss. Not as great as a net loss, but we still have it. I guess there was almost $6.5 million for legal and other professional fees associated with the company's recent stock option investigation, whose details are made public in January.
And some people are concerned that they're not going to apparently see all of the revenue later this year that they think they're going to from their sports franchises and such.
Yes, and they believe that the Grand Theft Auto series still has life in it. However, there is cause to be concerned. Because I guess last October, the founder and former chairman and chief executive officer, Ryan Brandt, pleaded guilty to filing false information in a court case as part of his role in a stock option backdating scheme.
Is that similar to the thing that they had with Steve Jobs here a while back? Something about the stock options and he knew something? And
I'm not familiar with that case,
It involves something with Mac, huh?
That could be part of the reason why. Or it could just be that I'm not very informed. Wait. Who said that? Where Bryant has agreed to pay $7.3 million in disgorgement, interest, and penalties. This all dates back to Take-Two settlement with the Securities and Exchanges Commission of June in 2005. This is interesting. What Take-Two would do is they would report false revenue from shipping unsolicited copies of games to retailers who were not required to pay for them, then mark on its balance sheets as sales before accepting the returned copies in a later financial quarter. Ooh.
Sneaky.
That sounds like strategy.
But it's not the strategy you're supposed to be using.
Yeah, well, the AI isn't supposed to cheat either.
There was something similar like this with a food service company a while back where they were reporting stuff as sold and then accepting the returns later. So it's not, they're not the first people to try it. They're also not the first people to get caught trying it either.
And they won't be the last.
No.
So unless there's anything else to say on the revenue up part, we move to this investors unhappy part, where in the New York Post and Reuters and several other notable media outlets, Take-Two investors began to discuss plans to oust the current CEO, Paul Eibler, back in February, led by 70-year-old self-made famed corporate raider, Carl Icahn, who between himself personally and his company went from 2.9 million shares down to 1.8 million shares, which had all been purchased of last August. But this group that Carl is leading, combined, these investors own 46% of the company. So I think when they have their annual general meeting on the 23rd of March, and they say, we're going to get rid of you, Eibler, we're going to get rid of, I think, pretty well all of the 9 board of directors, we're going to replace you with 6 other board of directors, I think they're probably going to be successful. I mean, unless every other stakeholder shows up and votes for the current executive. Interesting case of where a company is going to have its executive brought down by investors.
Well, let's hope whoever gets in there has an understanding of businesses isn't just some random corporate type who has no idea about the games industry, because that could be bad, actually bad for Take-Two.
Yes, and Take-Two could use some more bad things to happen to it. Academics rate Civ 1 and Civilization 2 amongst 10 important games of all time. Everyone had a chance to look at this list?
That's a pretty interesting list. I mean, they're going all the way back to the Space War in 1962, which is probably before most people listening were alive.
Yeah, I would substitute either this Space Wars or Star Invaders for Space Invaders. Oh, I love that game. Also, where is Pong on this list? And why do we have Super Mario Bros. 3 instead of the original Super Mario Bros.?
Insensible World of Soccer?
Yeah.
I'm not so sure about that one.
Yeah. I guess they were looking for a sports title. Maybe the Madden series, just throwing one of thousands of better examples out there. And since this is a Civ podcast, and so by a little more extension, a strategy podcast, they list the Warcraft series Yeah, we didn't just list the Civilization series, we listed the Warcraft series. If we're going to keep Warcraft, although I would argue substituting Doom 2 for it, change Warcraft to the original Warcraft released in 1994. Don't just say Warcraft series.
What?
Well, if you read in the GameSpy article, there were two submissions from each of the five people on the panel. I don't think there was any sort of standard as to whether it was a series or just one or two.
Mm.
But the series is still important to gaming.
I happen to be a major Warcraft fan, so I'm not going to agree that Warcraft isn't a good choice. I think it is a good choice here, and the Warcraft series. Presuming that it's a strategy series and not World of Warcraft, which isn't so good.
Yeah, because Civ is turn-based and Warcraft is real-time strategy, so you've got both aspects of strategy games represented that way. Although
Warcraft is actually played professionally, so
yes,
it is pretty important.
It and StarCraft, and you wouldn't have had StarCraft without Warcraft, so...
Yeah, so would you have had either of those games without Doom 2?
Doom 2 was a good game, but of course that wasn't really a series.
Yeah, it might have been the first one did that kind of strategy, but it wasn't the one that got the majority of the notice out of gamers. Some people did play it, but a lot of people didn't play it.
That's true, because there was some concern about what the criteria was, as with any of these kind of lists, where one user on Slashdot said that this list is more for games of great cultural significance, as opposed to first commercial successes. And yes, more people played Warcraft instead of Doom 2, but Henry Lowood, the curator of the History of Science and Technology collection at Stanford University in California, mentioned that both cultural and historical significance was important when choosing these titles. So I still say if we have to choose between Warcraft and Doom 2, we should have Doom 2 on there. But hey, at least we've got one of those on there. I think we can agree, though, we need to get rid of that Sensible World of Soccer. It's interesting, the mention of Civilization, actually. First of all, because from the articles that I've read and the discussions that I've seen, one of the few titles that is not debated over at all about whether it should be on the list or not, or in what capacity, is Civilization. Although one person on Slashdot did say they'd change that to Civilization 3. But then again, this same user... reference Master of Orion 3, so, you know, please go away.
It might have been sarcasm.
Possibly. But it's interesting. I mentioned both Civ 1 and Civ 2, yet what's talked about and the year that's referenced is Civilization 1. Of course, since they did kind of include, say, Warcraft series, I'm surprised they just didn't say Civilization series, unless maybe they specifically wanted to leave Civ 3 out.
That's very possible. What I'm surprised not to see on this list is, when we're talking about series, is the Ultima series of games. Because for role-playing games, that was a whole thing that inspired both the Dragon Warrior and the Final Fantasy series in Japan. So, where's Ultima? You guys forgot that one?
I think SimCity's a good choice, because that's an iconic game. The game was a SimCity instead of a series. Like, SimCity 2000 is pretty good as well.
Yeah, I actually enjoyed SimCity 2000 more than the original, but not SimCity 3000.
Right, I think the SimCity 2000 is probably the best in terms of when it was released. It was like better than SimCity 3000 or SimCity 4.
Yes, helping us establish the god game genre.
And the city building genre, because you have things like Caesar that later came and also Pharaoh.
Yeah, true.
You try building a city that can support enough stuff to build the pyramids. It's not easy.
Tetris is on this list.
Wasn't Pac-Man on there?
Because this was about I don't know, it says video games, and I don't know why it's not. I
suppose there's only 10 there, right?
Maybe perhaps they were trying to get a list of 10, and they had maybe 15 or 20 titles, and they had to put them all into a hat.
Not a good system.
And there's certainly titles that we hear at Polycast, and I'm sure our listeners agree, should be on there and aren't, and titles that should certainly be off, but are on there. Sensible World of Soccer. I want to mention it again, just because I can. But apparently the game canon was closely modeled on the work of the National Film Preservation Board, managed by the Library of Congress since 1989. But since we don't know anything about that, that really doesn't help us at all.
Well, it tells you right there, every year they compile a list of films to be added to the National Film Register. And I think maybe that's what they're going to try and do with the theme of the games here. Maybe not every year, but maybe every couple of years.
If there's a game that's not listed here that you would like to see, don't worry, all you have to do is wait.
God News, email news at apolton.net, or send a private message to Dan Q, Illuminatus, Snoopy369, or Grand Patrol via Polton's forums at apolton.net/forums.
So I guess it's Modcast time?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's right, Mackie. You're in love with the Modcast, so you probably would like to introduce these topics. Go ahead.
What?
Welcome to the Modcast, where we talk about hot issues in the forums.
So, You were thinking about the Modcast again, weren't you?
So our first topic in the Modcast is, looks like the Xbox Live service is coming to Windows, called Games for Windows Live for Vista. Now, I know nobody here has got Vista at the moment, but...
Imran! Oh, I'm sorry.
But he's not here.
Yay.
So cool. It's apparently supposed to come out May 8th with the new PC version of Halo 2 that's going to have some new achievements and a map editor. It's still going to have the same membership levels as Xbox Live, but the thing we're talking about here is if this gets applied to something like Civilization, would you pay for that service? You know, is the multiplayer part important enough to you to pay for that? I suppose it would probably still include direct IP and stuff, but that means that the main multiplayer base would probably move off of GameSpy and onto Xbox Live, which would give it a broader base, but I don't know.
Interesting. I don't think anything could be worse than GameSpy, so it may be good, but GameSpy is free.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. Things I've heard from friends, it might be worse.
I'm actually still using Windows 2000, so it's unlikely I'll be gear enough to upgrade to Vista.
Yeah, I think that is going to depend on how far Vista gets into the market for the games, because right now it's only a few people with really high-end systems that are even running it, and even so, I think a lot of people are dual-booting, because Vista is still a little cranky with older applications.
And the game companies are going to go for broadest markets, so they're going to support XP.
Oh yeah, at least for another few years, at least through their next release cycle, probably.
I read that Actor's going to be Service Pack 3 next year, and that Microsoft right now is saying that they are going to support Windows XP until 2013, so they say.
Yeah, that's like the opposite of what they were saying before Vista came out. We're not going to support it anymore. And then most of their corporate customers probably didn't buy Vista, and they said, okay, we'll support it. It's Microsoft for you.
But yeah, in terms of, you know, paying for these services, I mean, personally, no, but I don't engage in multiplayer gaming, so I'm not going to talk about me personally, but in paying for the service, I mean, you don't need to pay for Xbox Live, from what I understand, because there is the Silver membership, which is free. The Gold membership, which costs $50 a year, gives you all of the Silver features, which is, you know, gamertag, single-player achievements, text and voice chat, plus cross-platform gaming and TrueSkill matchmaking. I'm not familiar with Xbox Live, so I don't know what that means. Plus these additional offerings, and as far as I know, these additional offerings have not been defined yet, at least publicly. I think the best market Microsoft is going to get for Games for Windows Live is probably those who are cross-gamers. In other words, they use console titles, and they also play PC games because you don't have to pay for both Xbox Live and Games for Windows Live. You pay for one and you get the other. So I think most people, if they're getting frustrated with what we might call traditional ways of multiplayer gaming, which is, in other words, what's available now, such as GameSpy or making arrangement through fan sites like Apolton, Civ Fanatics, Civ 4 Ladder, etc. If they're getting frustrated with it, they might go to the Silver membership, but to actually pay for it, I mean, you're asking for $50 up front. Maybe they might get a little better off if they offered like a trial version.
And Silver seems to give a decent amount of functionality.
Mm-hmm. You just don't get the cross-platform part of it. Bet you at least would have easier arrangement for PC to PC, which I know is a problem for a lot of people with routers and firewalls when they try to even just to do GameSpy or even DirectIP or PipBoss.
Yeah, depending upon how configurable your router and your firewall is and how comfortable you are with messing with those things.
I think the biggest sticking point will be on Vista. At least they decide to make free XP too.
Yeah, because you think if they extended that to the XP users, they could have a lot of money up front.
I was actually kind of surprised to see that it would only be for Vista-driven PCs.
Well, they obviously want to try to get people to upgrade.
Yeah, it's another way of pushing Vista. We're on to you, Microsoft.
So they might, like, quietly in about a year make it for XP as well. So once people who are pushed easily have
you pushers.
Migrated.
And I think it'll also be dependent largely on Microsoft, how not only how well they do their advertising for games for Windows Live, but how well they do in going to other developers in the particular publishers and saying, hey, thinking about releasing a new game, would you consider highlighting us support it through Games for Live, either in addition to or maybe instead of GameSpy? I mean, because there's Microsoft Game Studios and they have a lot of in-house development and publishing, I think they have a really good base there. Plus, you know, Microsoft has money, apparently, from what I hear.
A lot of it.
So I think that'll help. But again, with the pay-for-services part, maybe not for reasons what they said before. I mean, this Xbox Live, Aaron Greenberg, he's the product manager, estimates that 70%, or that's 4.2 million Xbox 360 owners, are dual gamers who play games on console and PC, meaning, quote, that a broad adoption of this service will likely result. And I don't necessarily think that just because you do play PC games that you will... And if you have an Xbox Live account, doesn't necessarily mean you're going to use the Games for Windows Live component as well.
Yeah, just because you're using console doesn't mean you're already upgraded to Vista and all that too.
Because many people have a console because they can't be bothered getting a good game in PC.
Speaking from experience?
The games they play in the PC might be older ones.
Speaking from experience?
Well, the players. No, I'm the kind of person who doesn't have a console, just a powerful gaming computer.
I thought you didn't like consoles. Oh, that's
right.
That's why you can stay, because you don't have a console. I see how Dan operates.
Don't have a modern one.
You can stay.
Edmund T. Does
I have a PlayStation 1.
That's okay. We can get you help.
Oh, yeah.
And so another question that comes from Wouter, who couldn't be with us, is would you use these services in addition to or instead of a Bolt and Civilization Fanatics and Civ 4 Ladder? I know I addressed that myself, but Mackie, Blake, what do you guys think?
I'd rather keep using a Bolt because at least I know that the people I'm getting are not going to be little, well, kids, for lack of a not-so-rude word.
Kids? Very rude.
No, well, I was going to say brats, but...
Yeah, the thing about the Windows Live and those little services, I don't think has the same community. It's just kind of like playing as random people a lot, and that kind of misses the point of multiplayer, in my opinion. A lot of it, anyway. It's kind of a fun distraction, but I think that the multiplayer on a site of the community is better, especially for serious gaming.
Especially for something like Civ, which isn't a quick match, it's a few hours commitment.
Right. You're probably not going to get an epic game going on Windows Live.
No way. Heck, you can't get people to do anything slower than Blazing or a certain size of map on GameSpy now. I have to wait for the Saturday game if I want to have any sort of a decent MP game.
Also, a lot of popularity in Forbes, like the demo games and the PBMs and that. So,
yeah.
That's not going to be on a online service. Something like BitBoss probably could be, though.
Yeah, because in the thread on a Bolton, Krill, and talking about whether he'd pay for this, says that he'd be looking for a proper ladder a la Battlefield 2. He said would quote-unquote swing it at those prices, but I think there's already that comparable out there on fan sites. I think for, you know, what Blake and Mackie were getting at, the sense of community, I think that, you know, people who are already on fan sites might try out Games for Windows Live, but then they'll come back to fan sites.
Yes, very much. Come screaming back, probably.
Crawling back.
We're sorry, we didn't mean it. Take us back.
That's the magic word.
We'll buy a Pulton Plus. Next topic, we're talking about Civ 4 as the ultimate economics lesson. Now, this actually came out of a thread on Civ Fanatics, but hey, it's another Civ site. We cover all Civ, right?
Absolutely. Civ 4 as ultimate economics lesson.
What? What? You need to save and not spend.
That's funny.
I haven't read the thread, you say.
I didn't title the thread.
That's too long to read.
Sorry.
So yeah, this this user over at Sid Fanatics, Stratozic, declares that civilization is the ultimate economics lesson. Most people think economics as money, but that's not true. That would be finance. Economics is the science of choices in a constricted environment, unquote. Where, quote, often when you lose in Civ 4, it is because you beat yourself. You consistently invested in something that brought little return, unquote. I guess his underlying argument is that in playing Civ 4 well, you have proven yourself an amateur economist due to strategic management, deciding on a strategy and moving away from it when it will mean suffering. Well, let's see. Here's one issue. Difficulty level. I won on Pre-Settler. I'm an economist now.
Yes, I don't think he means it. Dan level and lower levels. Seriously, that's what we're calling it from now on. There's a Sid level, there's a Dan level.
Well, there is already a game length time named after me, so... I'm infamous! Oh, wait. I mean, famous!
I think you were right the first time.
I mean, the real-world economic system does not have fixed inflation, like in Civ 4, as pointed out by Xanax999. And no science rate in real life. You know, throwing money at progress does not necessarily mean progress. If only. I think a better way of putting this is what Elkino argues, that it helps with economic thinking as opposed to economic modeling. It's a good lesson in economics, but...
It's a good lesson in comparative advantage. Getting the most for your investment, for your resources. It doesn't teach about the economy itself, like, but about scarcity and that sort of thing. It does.
You know, I suppose it's more of an ultimate investment lesson than an economics lesson.
What's this? I don't have any iron in my cultural borders. Okay. World builder.
No. You invest in a stack of death and go next door to your neighbor who has iron.
You know, that's nicely said.
Walk softly and carry a big stack of death.
Yes, tie in.
I like this sentence from the original post. Don't plan to become a doctor by dropping out of school to join a hippie commune.
Hippie commune.
That sort of makes sense.
And this Stratozic writes that he doesn't plan on being a conqueror by delaying bronze working for meditation. Civ 4 has different victory conditions, so I think it kind of depends on what kind of conqueror you're looking to be, you know, both in terms of type and time of execution, right? I mean, You can conquer by culture.
Not really. You can,
in
like,
a way,
try to.
Yes.
You can spend all game trying to get a city to flip, and maybe it will right at the end, but... There's a real conqueror is best done bronze working.
Well, now, if you play on dual size map and you cram it with as many civs as possible on there, it's...
And you play on Dan difficulty.
I suppose it's really a thread more about the economics of play as opposed to the actual game economics. Because do you want to spend this much time investing in a cultural win only to realize you're going to fail when you could have already won the world by conquering?
Yes, so every situation is different.
If you have Montezuma as a next-door neighbor, forget the cultural.
Well, because Stratozic talks about how in Civ 4 you are officially constrained right from the beginning when it comes to starting position, traits, and land. Okay, for a starting position, yeah, okay, restarts and modifications and world builder notwithstanding. traits, to some degree, you know, such as those that are unique to each civilization and leader, but in another, no, I mean... For example, you might end up with a leader that's culturally strong, but you are not constrained to follow a cultural path to victory. But this part about being constrained as far as land goes?
Well, if you end up on an island that supports two cities when everyone else is on a Pangaea, then that's definitely constrained. Or if you keep having games like I'm having where there's this huge swath of desert between you and everyone else, which is sort of great as a buffer, but sort of not great because you're sort of choked in. I think that's what he's meaning.
Oh, because there is such a thing as galleys and galleons.
And how far up the tech tree do I have to wait to that while I'm still trying to research bronze working and agriculture? And yeah, it's not something that's the first thing you get. And if you happen, your little island happens to be out in the middle of nowhere where you can't get to without navigation, you're definitely constrained. For our third topic this week, we're going to talk about fortresses and how useless or not they might be. Maybe less on the or not side, I guess.
Yes. So we're talking about the standard in-game improvement of forts available after researching mathematics. 25% tile defense bonus. Ooh, shiny.
And like the thread says, pretty much useless. Every once in a while you might have a use.
I think I might have used them once, but no.
I use them to decorate my deserts.
So do I.
General Rommel mentions their good use on choke points between continents and such, and also gathering points for your armies, as he does not like to gather his armies in cities.
Well, he's got a point, especially in a multiplayer game. If somebody's got religious view into your cities, it's better to put your units off in some square you know they can't see, so they could think you're under-defended. That strategy again, Dan.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, I think I used one the other day in an MP game because there's a huge area of ice to the north of my territory, and I'm not going to bother to settle a bunch of mediocre cities up there, but there's still barbarians coming down. But I have one little choke point, and I build a fort there and put a couple of guys up there, so when the barbarians come down, I just whack them. And I think that's only about the third or fourth time I've actually had a need for a fort since I've had so far.
Occasionally on the Highlands map, you get nice choke points you would have fought on. Highlands is a bit unique because of where you do get those choke points. On most maps, you don't. There's always another way around.
Mm-hmm. Usually by sea.
Yeah, because wouldn't the value of choke points, as far as fortresses go, diminish as you as your seagoing ability increases? Once we have, you know, units that could actually defend our port galleys and such. And then we get airports later, and that's just icing on the cake. I realize that's limited in terms of number of units per turn, but still. So choke points early on in the game, maybe there's a use. But then as gathering points for your armies, well, I don't know. Wouldn't you just better off building a road on a tile that you want to use as a gathering point for resources and then gather them in terrain that maybe offers this or even greater tile defense instead, like hills, forest, jungle?
Oh, that's what you do. You pick some hill somewhere you're not using in any of your cities, and you put the fortress there, and you put your army there.
Except usually the gathering point kind of moves forward to the front line as you, you conquer stuff with your arms, you just have it sitting around.
Yeah, and usually if I'm in the middle of concrete through some of the ship's territory, I'm going to sit in the cities, which has a better defense anyway.
And from what I understand, was it in the Warlords expansion or with the 2.08 patch, you can now build forts in forests? Is that true?
Yeah, it is true. And I think they also act as a city for terms for promotions, like they act as a city for things like archer, city defense, and city raider on attack. So you can use city raider units to break open a fort in case someone's stupid enough to use one.
Oh, yeah!
So you could have your units in like, on a nice flat fort, flat little land and not vulnerable city raider, or put them in a fort and make them vulnerable city raider. So, forts are not that useful.
No, because if you're going to keep your forests, perhaps thinking that you'll move to lumber mills if it's within your city radius. I mean, you can build fort and fortress, but you can't have both a fort and the lumber mill there.
Right.
So unless you're otherwise set with your tile improvements, I think your workers' time is probably spent better elsewhere. And by the time it or they're in this position, lumber mills are probably likely available anyway. So
Or railroads.
I liked in terms of a suggestion of what to do with these poor things. The zone of control from Civilization 3, perhaps if we had a reintroduction of that, that might help breathe some life back into these poor, useless, shiny things.
I would have said put them out of their misery, but
Boo, zone of control, boo. I don't miss that.
Is it that you don't miss the idea of it, or just you don't miss the implementation?
I think the implementation.
And I think a zone of control would actually be appropriate for it, although I'd make it a cross shape of them, so you'd have to use interlock multiple forts in order to create a proper barrier.
Really block it up.
Poor forts, they never had a chance.
Nope.
Just decorations.
Shiny!
Dan likes the shiny. This is our last topic this week. Is future tech way overpowers? Well, how many games do you actually get to future tech?
I remember one.
I know. For the amount of times I actually get in a game as far as future tech, it doesn't really seem to be that overpowered. It's just plus one health and plus one happy.
And usually you're pretty much maxed by then anyway.
Right, you're usually maxed on how much food you can produce for your city by then in happiness anyway, so don't think plus one and plus one is not that overpowering. And they never in the Civ games wanted to go and start detailing some of the future techs, like someone is suggesting here, lightsabers. No. Because at that point, it starts becoming more Master of Orion and less civilization.
Yeah, or more galactic civilizations.
Right.
Plus, also, a future technology is 10,000 light bulb cost. Once you are able to build future technology, how many people are really going to, for example, still have their science rate at 100%? If it was still at 100% before then, it's going to take you a while to get to that future tech anyway.
Yeah.
Scientists, specialists, and notwithstanding, for example.
At that point, I think in a game, if you were playing against other players, you'd probably be dropping your science rate down to cash so you could rush the parts of the spaceship.
You can't rush projects. You can use rushed units to defend yourself or take others.
Exactly. You'll have other uses for your income at that point, so it's not that overpowered, if at all.
The one game where I did use future tech is a Realms Beyond game. One of the variant objectives was to get a big city, so I had to get a very high healthy cap. I got the city to size 48 at the end of the game. Size 48
wow.
City. That was cool. So I needed to, like, 20 future tech or maybe 30. So I just teched up at that and researched away while the AIs did AI things. Not launching their spaceship because they're slow. And I got my size 48 city.
Wow.
Yeah, it was worth it. But of course there's no real reason to get a size 48 city unless it's just for the hell of it. Which is a pretty good reason, but I'm never going to do it again.
I don't think I've seen cities that size since Alpha Centauri.
Yeah, because Mackie's, you already mentioned, you know, some people suggesting, you know, we get lightsabers and start guessing what future technology might be. But from a gameplay standpoint, if you get more specific and varied with future technologies, it could lead into something we touched on in episode 10, where we ended up with, like in Civilization Call to Power, we have these cities in space, and they go unnecessarily going beyond the scope of the game, and they're not going to be terribly balanced. They're either going to have to be ridiculously overpowered to be of any use,
yeah,
or they're just going to be piecemeal efforts, and then what's the point?
You're in the end game anyway. It's not going to put that much more to your score to build bigger city and, or cities underwater or cities in space. And if you wanted to play that, go play Alpha Centauri.
I'm not really sure what else we can do with future technologies. I mean, in Civ 4, it's definitely improved over previous Civ titles, like, you know, when they just added to your final score.
Yeah, at least you get an in-game bonus to go with it.
I mean, the only tweaks I see possibly future technologies, is you could have maybe a randomness factor of whether you would get a plus one boost in health or happiness or commerce or research itself, maybe even. But otherwise, I think where it's at right now, it just coasts.
It serves its role, which is give a use of beakers at the end of the game, really past the end of the tech game, if you want to spend beakers on things, which isn't gold.
Yes, I believe it's Sword of Striker in this thread, and this is over at Civ Fanatics, by the way. But it's like, quote, well, honestly, if you haven't won the game by the time you get future check, you need all the help you can get, unquote. So, I think he's got it right.
Unless you're trying to build a size 50 city.
Or trying not to launch the spaceship or something.
Yeah.
I guess that leaves us with the Senate, does it? Would you like to introduce our Senate topics, Blake?
Open borders.
Thank you. Yes, open borders. Read the whole. Welcome to the Senate. In this section, we talk about game strategy.
On a Senate, we've got the topic of open borders to attack a third party. I guess it refers to using the strategy of using a third party's open border to launch an invasion on a fourth party.
Again, this is over at Civilization Fanatic Center, civfanatic.com forums. Vermeer is looking to invade another continent. Ooh, where the Melanese and the Indians lie. And he has open borders with both of them. And he ferries his army into Indian territory to take on Mansa. And with Mansa's culture at a marked disadvantage to their Indian neighbors, he is able to capture and raise a border city before quickly rolling back into Indian territory. Where, quote, Gandhi doesn't seem to mind that I'm using his territory to attack his friend, and Mansa doesn't seem annoyed with Gandhi. I guess the AI can't take these fine points into account, unquote.
You'd think at some point. Yeah, you think at some point one of them would be declaring war on the other, because, hey, why aren't you letting them through?
So he wants to know if this is a common tactic to employ in a situation like this. Well, as demonstrated from this example,
yeah.
Yes.
Next topic.
Yeah, the AI does it all the time.
Yeah.
I guess the reason there isn't a penalty against from one civ to the other against it is because it would mess up the AI relations so much, and it wouldn't be worth the penalty on the player. That's my only guess as to why they haven't done that.
Well, because it's difficult to actually tell when it's happening. Exactly.
Yeah, so Chicago Cubs notes to watch the diplomatic relations between your target and other civs to make certain that the territory of the open border civilization you want to roll and return to your units across is on bad terms with the civilization that you are targeting. That would probably help. Because otherwise, he says, your border deal may be canceled, and then your units could be bumped into less than ideal terrain, like, you know, your new enemies. And you could open yourself to attacks from multiple sides. And of course, if there is a defense pact between these two civilizations, well, look out. But Joe Blade suggests a preemptive strategy, which is to bribe the open border civilization to cancel their deals with your target civilization before those two can do the same to you. Ooh. If we're able to get them to agree to it, of course.
Good luck with that.
Especially if they're, you know, brothers of the faith, that could be difficult. Where JKP1187 prefers amphibious attacks to initiate a long-distance war, using ships to lower the target city defenses. But in Vermeer's case, he's at the frigate and galleon level of technology, yeah. So...
Yeah, I don't think you even have the amphibious promotion. And you'll get a huge penalty coming straight off the ships into the city.
You can still bombard frigates, so to lower defenses.
True, and you still might be able to take it, and then it would be your foothold for going into the rest, and it wouldn't be so hard. I guess it depends on how much you're willing to sacrifice to get that kind of a foothold city.
Yeah, that's true. Just how valuable is that city? How many frigates are you willing to put to this, and just what kind of defense does this city have?
Another note on the open border exploits like that is using the station, your air force, and the cities of another player, because the aircraft can go to any city you've got open borders with.
That's very true.
So in the case like our original example, he could have also put his bombers in Gandhi cities and then bombing across the border into Mali.
Yes, if he had air tech, which he doesn't.
Which, of course, will be useful so long as cities you're able to move fighters and bombers into can actually reach the targets, seeing as how we don't have airfields anymore.
The other thing being is if the enemy happens to move a unit into one of these cities, all your aircraft die. So either put a real unit in there with them, or like do it with someone who's close borders if you're a victim.
Yes. Not so powerful now that you're not in the air, eh?
I think ships can actually destroy aircraft, too. Coastal cities. You just got to be a bit careful when you put non-land units into open border cities.
Yeah, yeah. They need to stop parking their planes so close to the water.
I think that's a pretty despicable tactic.
Oh, which you never use, of course.
Yeah.
No, usually try to go get a foothold, then put in the bombers, and then bomb the heck out of everything.
Well, at least you use carriers.
Yeah, it's usually how you get the first city down easier.
Or you could just go into the world builder and...
No, that's the Dan style of
tie-in.
How to play like Dan. Open world builder.
World builder is not strategy.
And so I think that leaves us with just one more topic.
Wonder.
Oh.
The wonder.
It's the wonder discussion, Fred.
Which wonders to build?
So which wonders do we build?
Well, I actually put together a 10 best list.
10 is quite a lot.
I know, because actually since there are only, 33 in the game. However, my list gives room for strategy.
What? Strategy?
Yes.
It's true. And options, too. There are options. Multiple paths. Ooh.
So start telling us so we can tell you why you're
yes,
wrong.
Yes, we want to ridicule you.
What else is new? Okay, on my 10 best list, I have my first combo, which I call the Ancient Culture Bomb combo of Stonehenge and Oracle, where if you must choose between Stonehenge and Oracle, I would choose the Oracle because you can build your own obelisks, you know, for only 30 hammers apiece.
And also free tech.
That's nice.
Oh, really?
Of course, it would be even more valuable if it was a free technology every turn after you built it, but okay.
Use a
world builder. Yeah, there you go. There's the best wonder, the world builder. Why isn't this documented?
No, but that is good, actually, when you're trying to do a cultural victory. because it gets all of your early cities off to a good cultural start by getting the extra obelisks. And then you also have the great profit points in your main, or whatever city ends up building Stonehenge. It's usually your capital city. So you're able to generate great profits there. And as you get religions, you can turn out their shrines a lot faster, too. Or light bulb, once all the religions have been founded. So it's actually not a bad one.
Yeah, and besides, don't anyone ever complain about the cost of Stonehenge either. I mean, 120 hammers, can't even get a national wonder for that price.
Also depends on whether you also have the time and resources to devote to it, too, because you don't have quite as many hammers back then in the ancient age.
That's true. But an oracle's only 30 hammers more than 150, so if you go either way.
Yeah, when you have production, when you have a strong capital city, it's an excellent way to give all future cities a jump-start in development, at least for non-creative leaders. For creative, you probably only want it for the profit points.
Yes, and especially if you're not able to found an early religion. Well, maybe later on, you know, somebody else beats you to Hinduism and
Buddhism or Judaism.
Yeah, thank you. If you're looking for maybe Christianity or Islam later, you know, you can have this as kind of an insurance policy in case you actually don't get that. And if you have access to stone.
Usually it takes a long time for stone up.
Yeah.
At least in the higher difficulties.
Exactly. Usually somebody's built Stonehenge by the time you can hook up some stone.
But if you do hook it up, you're often building like 5 tunes, just like in case it doesn't go. You can't rely on getting it, but it's really cheap, so it's not too light.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's true that Stonehenge does become obsolete. And do I remember correctly that Oracle does not?
It doesn't become obsolete. But,
yeah, but after that free tech, you don't get much use out of it other than the great profit points.
And they never become obsolete for any wonder. So there's no difference between it never going obsolete and immediately going obsolete because the only effect is a culture and the great people point to never change.
What else is on your list?
Next on my list is what I call the great combo, the great library and the great lighthouse. I mean, great library, you've got a nice culture boost and you get some great scientist people. Then with the great lighthouse, unless you're playing on, Pangaea with no consistent access to coast, and without hesitation, if you're, you know, playing on an island map, I mean, get lighthouse. I guess the only downside is its ultimate obsolescence, but that's not much of a downer.
No, it's far enough down the tech path you get a lot of use out of it. Especially if you combine it in Colossus.
So why was it the great combo?
Well, great that and great library.
Impressive.
Because they both have great in the title.
Most impressive.
Oh, I can't believe I have to explain these things. Come on now, Blake. This is your second time around. why is it that the great lighthouse becomes obsolete with corporation?
I think it's because of new trading companies and that. I don't know. Something like that.
Yeah. Plus, the Great Lighthouse also gives you great merchant points, which that's only one of 5 great wonders that offers this specific great person bonus.
Yeah, so you don't want to build it in the Great Library in the same city, actually.
No.
Don't want to pollute your great person pool, because otherwise you're sitting there and it's like playing the lotto. What great person am I going to get this time?
Great merchants are good, though.
Which sometimes you have no choice if you don't have any good other good production cities in your capital, but when you can separate it out, it's nice.
The plus one ship movement effect in Civ 3 was for the Great Lighthouse was also nice, but...
No, you don't get that this time.
No, and the ability for galleys to travel safely.
Don't get that either.
At sea.
That was actually a good move, though. Getting a galley all the way to the Americas? No.
Next on my list is the, what I call the French combo, Notre Dame and Eiffel Tower.
No Versailles?
Now, what was that now?
Wait, where's Versailles in this? Oh, wait, we're wonders, not national wonders. Never mind.
Yes. I'll actually talk about Versailles a little later on, believe it or not, for reasons that I'll explain later. They're both culturally based projects, and Notre Dame, plus 10 culture and plus grade 2 artist, with plus 1 happiness in all cities on the same continent? Woo. That's pretty nice.
Yeah, that's one to go for if you can get it.
It's a mere 50 hammer difference and negligible research tree appearance difference between this and Sistine Chapel. And yes, Sistine provides plus 2 culture per specialist in all cities. Aw, too bad.
Depends on whether you're running a specialist having economy or not, whether that would be good, though.
It's excellent for cultural victories where you have lots of artists.
Yeah.
Yeah, usually I only end up with specialists in cities if they're great persons, or if later on, workers in cities don't have anything else to do because they're size 20 and above. Anyway, that's just me.
Yes, for those that play higher than Dan level, though, we run into happiness caps and health caps, and at that point you can take some people off of working food to make them specialists. That way at least they're being useful. Strategy.
Woo! Exciting.
And Eiffel Tower is good, I think, almost with any kind of game, because you get a free broadcast tower in every city, and if you're going on conquering through somebody, you get that broadcast tower right away, which means you don't have to wait so long for the culture borders to push back out. So it makes your conquest go through faster.
Epic's useful, too.
Yeah.
But it's still a pretty late game wonder, so it's not really that significant.
No, you'll probably get more news out of Notre Dame.
Which is one I almost never build, just because I'm music, which I don't usually get. And it's very expensive.
Yeah, it is a little on the expensive side, but by that point in the game, you could probably manage it, hopefully.
Yeah, and it's cheap with stone, I believe, so that makes it more affordable.
And so then that brings me to my final combination, where this is what I call the modern culture bomb combo. Any two of Broadway, rock and roll, and Hollywood. I mean, we've got all plus 50% culture and plus 2 great artist people points. At least to start, anticipate only being able to build 2. I would consider Hollywood a bonus, and that's because you will be able to get Broadway and rock and roll on the technology tree first. And also Hollywood costs 200 hammers more than either Broadway or rock and roll.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you'd want to, I think, put Broadway and rock and roll. If you're trying for cultural victory and you needed those two other cities for legendary, it's good for those two cities other than your capital city that you're trying to get to legendary, because that'll speed them up a lot.
Broadway can be an excellent wonder when you need to trade some additional resources. That's especially true in a one-city challenge when there's very much a shortage of resources you can trade, so being able to trade for, like, 4 extra health resources can be very useful.
Yes, exactly. So in addition to the culture and the artists, the additional resources that it brings you is also another nice bonus.
I think resources are of primary benefit.
Yes, because what other wonder is going to be able to bring that to you? But also, if you combine this modern culture bomb combo and you also have Eiffel Tower, too, wah. This sounds like nobody was disagreeing with any of my selections. Yay for me, gold star. But were there any other wonders that perhaps I didn't put on my list that we should be generally shooting for?
Well, if you get into the modern era and up there, you're missing the Three Gorges Dam. Puts power plants in all of your cities on that continent. And that can be a huge production boost.
I thought about that one.
Yeah, see, it doesn't matter whether you're going for cultural or some sort of conquest or what, or the spaceship victory, you need that one.
I guess the reason I left that off the list partially was because there are other options. Not as ideal, obviously, although first of all, if you're playing on an island map, for example, that's not going to be as the same benefit as if you're on Pangaea. But also, if you have a lot of cities that, for example, have rivers running through them, then you have the nice hydroplant option. And without the pollution effects, the unhappiness effects, there is also coal. And in some cities, you might not even need to be bothered with a power plant where the benefits will be negligible. I guess I would throw in the Three Gorges Dan as kind of an 11th and honorary member of the list. How nice of me.
You're so generous.
I know. Wow. It's true.
Yeah, we got mail.
And it wasn't spam.
That was another surprise.
Call in today in North America, 301-637-7659. That's 301-637-POLY. In Europe, 44-20-7871-7659. That's 44-20-7871-POLY. Or Skype us directly through using Skype from Skype.com. Direct your calls to the Polycast.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on the show, including how to write in, where to find the official Polycast forum, and how to subscribe to the RSS feed, log on to the official Polycast website at polycast.apolton.net.
Type more quietly.
Yeah, man. Seriously.
That is next.
That's what my freaking keyboard makes, damn it.
Take-Two Interactive news item. We're talking about that, what's his name, Carl Icahn.
Mm-hmm.
I got looking at the list on Forbes.com, and I thought, how many of these billionaires hold United States citizenship? 380 of the 891 billionaires. Yes, there are 891 billionaires in the world, and no, neither myself, Blake, or Mackie are one of them. Surprise!
Yeah, if we were billionaires, we wouldn't have time for this.
We wouldn't bother with this. Oh, no, wait.
Oh.
Not me.
So we didn't get any more emails this week?
Well, I didn't get any, so
maybe
I should delete them.
Well, if you didn't get any, the rest of us most certainly did not. Well, thank you very much, Blake, for coming in at the last minute. Wow.
You're welcome.
It's good to have you back.
Kind of made a bad enough first impression.
Well, at least we don't have you up really, really, really early like last time.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for listening to the 11th episode of Polycast, the official podcast of a Polton Civilization site. I've been joined by Mackie.
Hello and goodbye.
And Blake.
Hello and yes, bye.
And so I guess that just leaves me, since I didn't bother to say who I was. It's because I'm saving the best for last, you see. I am Daniel Quick, known as Dan Q on the forums. Hello and goodbye.
Quick, someone gets to pop his ego. It's getting too large.
Record date March 17th, 2007. Soundtrack courtesy Civilization IV and the Warlords Expansion Pack. Copyright 2007, a Polton Civilization site at apolton.net.